Thank you. As you're getting settled, I'm sure you're aware the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust the podium to your level, and please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carl Christensen. I represent one of the defendants, Reach Companies.
That's the only appellant, right?
That's the only appellant. That's right, Your Honor. A brief recitation of the facts. The facts are quite simple here. The other defendant, David Ehrlich, was an employee of Plaintiff Web. Let's call him Web. Web Business Promotions.
You know, I'm going to assure you, you don't have a lot of time here, Mr. Christensen. And
great.
We've read the briefs. So I think we know the facts. And so, why is this case that this, and the only issue that was appealed was the issuance of this temporary injunction, which is now expired. Why are we here? Why isn't this a moot issue?
Because there's a motion for contempt of court that has turned into an evidentiary hearing that's due to be heard on April 2nd. A moot, as the court already briefed us, it's your prerogative to raise mootness. It's a jurisdictional issue. It can be raised sua sponte. A case is moot if there's no justiciable controversy. The definition of a justiciable controversy is one that involves definite and concrete assertions of right. That concrete and definite assertion of right is currently to be heard before Judge Cork on the 4th. Now, you may not be aware, because it happened yesterday, but plaintiff has written a letter to the judge asking for the motion to be withdrawn and the hearing to be stricken, which creates, I think, a little more nuanced question for this court. The court has not done anything with that, and we've responded to that and said, look, that we're entitled to—
I understand all that, but I don't understand how that is our concern here. Our concern here is whether there's a relief we can grant either by affirming or not the granting of this temporary injunction. And, you know, what the district court does on any contempt motion seems to me what you're wanting us to do here is give someone an advantage at the district court. Based upon our ruling, so someone can argue to the district court either that the Court of Appeals affirmed this or didn't. Quite frankly, the contempt issue is going to be taken care of long before we ever issue a decision in this case, because we'll have 90 days from today to do that. So you still haven't convinced me that there's even a justiciable issue for us to decide anymore.
The basis of the contempt issue is a violation of the injunction, which means that there is a definite and concrete assertion of right that plaintiffs have made. They're saying that this injunction was violated. And the mere
During the term
of the injunction itself. And the fact that the injunction has expired on its own terms doesn't mean there aren't rights that are being adjudicated under the injunction. That's the whole purpose of the motion for contempt, and that's the whole purpose of the evidentiary proceeding. We're not trying to garner some advantage in this court before the district court. We're trying to actually bring our claims and defenses as they relate to the injunction, and that issue's still live, even though there can't be any further actions related to the injunction after its expiration in late January. So I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, to the tenor of the question, and that is that this is not we're not asking for an advisory opinion here. We're not asking you to tell the court what to do. We're asking for you to rule on the propriety of this injunction, which is still a live issue before the court. I reference the correspondence before the district court yesterday to say that even if the court were inclined to honor their request to withdraw, the motion would be entitled to damages related to the impropriety of the injunction, and we plan to seek relief for those damages. And if there were a bond that would have been imposed in this case, then Rule 65 would have given us a path to seeking damages. We would be able to apply by motion for redress through the bond. But that exposes a greater issue with the impropriety of this injunction. As the court is aware, what we briefed is that because the lower court didn't even give a basis for the for not imposing a bond. That was an abuse of its discretion. And now that error is going to be further promulgated by the fact that we're left with no recourse for plaintiff's action. And it's sort of capricious actions as it relates to this injunction. So this issue is live. And the motion for contempt is not an island upon itself. It is born of and is a child of this injunction. So I think that answers the question related to mootness, unless the court has any other questions. I do have one other point. As the court is also aware, there are issues. The mootness doctrine is not supposed to be rigidly enforced. There are legal issues that would make something not moot. That is, if the particular issue being appealed is capable of repetition, or there's collateral consequences.
So I assume you're not telling us you're going to continue to violate it.
No, not at all, Your Honor. No, and my letter to Judge Cork, I said that the motion for contempt and the progeny of the injunction is the collateral consequences. In my further research, I realized that's just not correct. This court is aware the collateral consequences is an issue that comes up a lot in the context of criminal cases. It's something that happens that's not part of the relief sought or the actual remedy, but it's something that nonetheless affects the person. In the instance of the criminal world, it's loss of voting rights or being a felony or inability to get housing because of a criminal record. So I mistakenly refer to that as collateral consequences, but the point is that in the Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Company versus...
Well, rather than going down the road, I suppose you can make an argument that if this injunction is out there, it might affect your client's future employment either at this company or another company, or who wants to have an injunction hanging out there? That could be a problem. I get that. But let's get to the heart of the matter. I have to admit, I keep getting confused whether it's a milk straw or the water straw. But in any event, I seem to recall some evidence in the record indicating that your client, I don't know, it was on a Facebook page or whatever the heck it was, but admitted to using the one he wasn't, admitted to selling the one he wasn't allowed to sell. Isn't that sort of, we're done? It seems to me that would be dispositive. If your client is admitting that he's violating the non-compete by selling the thing he's not supposed to sell, I don't see how we would be able to argue that the district court's issuance of an injunction based on that factual record is an abuse of discretion.
Because because the district court didn't make a factual record, why was granted the injunction?
Well, rather than go there, as an appellate court, we can look at the record and see if the record supports the district court's decision. Am I correct in stating that the record supports an admission by your client to having sold the thing the non-compete said he couldn't sell?
He was involved with...
He went to this trade fair or something, and wasn't there a Facebook said, selling these milk straws. Yeah, the milk straws. He couldn't sell the water ones.
He can sell the water straws. He was promoting the company. I don't recall what the communications were related to that, but I do recall in the affidavit of my client, he was involved with some small amount of milk straw sales where customers said, hey, I'm buying this thing, can I buy milk straws? And he passed those sales off to somebody else.
Well, does the agreement allow him to sell any milk straws? I don't recall anything in the agreement saying you can sell a little bit of milk straws. It seemed to me it was pretty categorical.
The agreement doesn't say anything about milk straws. The agreement says...
Well, is that one of the items that he was forbidden from selling under the terms of the non-compete?
I don't mean to be coy here, Your Honor, but the non-compete says that he can't divulge information related to vendors. He can't divulge information relating to customers. He can't divulge information relating to products. He can't divulge information relating to business systems. And so the underlying question was, what is it that he purportedly did? And to the extent to which we sought clarification from Webb to tell us what conduct was prescribed by this agreement, they didn't do it. The milk straws and water straws argument came up solely...
Is it a fair statement, Mr. Christensen, that he was also not permitted to work in the United States for a competitor of Webb or solicit its customers?
But the injunction says that he can work for a competitor of Webb, and that's the problem with the injunction. It says he can sell water straws, and he is in...
But by implication, not milk straws.
Exactly. And so the question then becomes how... First of all...
And your client sells milk straws.
Right.
Or the company that employed Mr. Ehrlich.
Correct.
Okay.
And so the question...
So how can he work there?
Because the standard for an injunction is not merely that he is doing something that a contract says he can't do. The standard for injunction is that they have to show that irreparable harm, or they will suffer irreparable harm, that there's a legitimate business purpose to this, and they have to define what it is, the confidential information, the damages they think they're going to suffer, and why this injunction is the only, is the remedy that, why an injunction is appropriate when monetary damages won't do.
The agreement does not have language in it that says, like most good non-competes, a violation of this agreement, it is presumed a violation of this agreement results in irreparable harm. It doesn't say that.
I don't recall, Your Honor, okay. But the truth is that the Webb never argued why it was irreparable harm and why damages alone wouldn't make them whole. And that's the reason why we're here. And then the fashioning of the injunction itself creates a number of problems where he can still work with my client and he can still sell water straws, which are deemed to be non-competing goods, but he's sitting next to the person who's selling milk straw products, and he's sitting in the same room as the person that's selling the lip balm products. And so the question then becomes, going back, is that what is the irreparable harm? If he can be there selling one product and be in proximity of people that are selling the other, why would damages alone not be sufficient to suffice?
Because I assume your client, Mr. Ehrlich, was such a good salesman, which is, I assume, why the new company hired him as a national sales rep, is it's not damages alone. We don't want his unique expertise, which we employed for whatever couple years, including giving him a $7,500 payment as part of a severance package to reiterate the non-compete. We don't want him doing all this because we'll lose a ton of money.
But why? The question would be why. They don't say what the unique expertise is. All their customer information is public. All the methods that are purportedly confidential, Webb has already told my client in a previous contract they went under. Webb has said that sales solicitation to the other company's customers is not a violation of a non-compete in a different matter. And he actually has been brought in another matter. He's been brought forward for violating a trademark settlement agreement, and there's an injunction against him from my client. So why would he be entitled to this extraordinary relief? And what we're saying here isn't that there isn't a method by which this agreement could touch on all the bases of a proper non-compete in which an injunction would be appropriate. We're saying the facts before the lower court were not the facts could allow it to do it, and it didn't make any of the findings that were appropriate. We don't even need to get into the non-compete to look at the abuse of discretion. As I said before, we can just talk about the bond issue. And before the lower court, we briefed that a bond would be appropriate. Webb didn't respond to that argument and proffered no argument related to the bond. Rule 54 says that the district court must issue a bond, and the case law says if it's its discretion not to, but it has to tell us how it got there by applying the facts and the law, which it didn't do. So,
well, maybe because by the time you folks got around to getting a district court order, there was only 4 or 5 months left on this temporary injunction, and it really, maybe the court just didn't consider it a significant issue, and how would it be abusing its discretion by not considering it in light of the relatively short time that there was life left in this injunction?
Well, because it is a significant issue because there's more life left in it because now we're facing a contempt hearing, and it's also a significant issue.
Don't you have a remedy for that, though, in the underlying? I mean, you still got an underlying cause of action for breach of contract and tortious interference and things like that. Isn't your remedy on this contempt to address those issues in the ultimate disposition of the case and any appeals that someone might take from that disposition?
No, because the basis of the contempt is violation of the injunction. It's not the underlying claims. So we're not going to get to the merits of the claims. We're going to get to the injunction of whether or not my client violated it, whether or not my client's employee violated that. But going back before, the question was whether or not the judge could be excused from making the appropriate factual findings because there wasn't much life left in this injunction? And the answer is no. The Minnesota Supreme Court says absolutely not. The court needs to make factual findings to allow for review, even if the tenure of the injunction is short. And that applies for the bond, and it also applies for the underlying injunction itself. And there was only one factual finding. The only finding, and it may not even have been a finding, the only finding was that water straws are not an infringing product, or not a product that's prescribed by the agreement. But that may have just been a recitation of what our position was before the court. So there may actually be zero factual findings. And so, no, Your Honor, respectfully, I say the court's not excused from its duty to make factual findings and apply the law to the facts to allow for this to be reviewed. I see my time is up. I'll reserve the rest of my arguments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Christensen. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning, counsel. May it please the court. I'm Jeff Metcalf, and I represent Respondent Web Business Promotions Incorporated in this matter. And while we briefed a number of issues to this court in my limited time here this morning, I wish to focus on 3 points. The first, of course, that we've discussed or was discussed during appellant's argument is that this appeal is moot now. Given
well,
that the injunction.
First of all, because it's not in the record, I mean, do you agree that you have written a letter to the district court withdrawing? Well, what letter did you write to the district court?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. Perhaps I could just give a brief recap of our motion for contempt. We were before the court in early January when the injunction was still in effect. And then at that hearing, the district court then pushed out for an evidentiary hearing in April. And it's our view that civil contempt, and as this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated many times, civil contempt is about making sure that the parties comply with the court's order. It's prospective, it's not a punishment for past acts. So given that the injunction has since expired, we thought it prudent and a good use of, or a better use of judicial resources, rather to strike this from the calendar. And so yes, we've asked to have the evidentiary hearing stricken, and we have withdrawn our motion for contempt. So returning to the 3 points.
Well, then why isn't this moot? I mean, as Judge Flory asked at the beginning. I mean, it seems to me, why isn't this moot?
Your Honor, I would agree. This is absolutely moot. We have, again, an injunction that has expired over a month ago. Really, our position is, Your Honor, is that we want to get this case set for trial. I don't think having an evidentiary hearing is going to be a good use of resources, a good use of time. We want to proceed, and we want to just move on with discovery and final resolution of the case. But the point is, yes, we agree that this matter is moot and should be dismissed on that basis. The second point is, Your Honor, is that
maybe it's the snow. I guess if it's moot, then shouldn't you sit down and stop arguing, and we should dismiss this from the bench?
I'm happy with that outcome, Your Honor. I agree that it's moot, and quite frankly, I think we should be moving on with the case towards final resolution.
Well, the appeal is moot, not the case.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the appeal is moot. We wish to continue with the case.
Well, assuming we're not going to rule from the bench, then your position, I assume, regarding the issuance of the temporary injunction is that there was no abuse of discretion. And if we get by mootness, then we'll need to address that issue. I know you've briefed that, but what's your strongest argument for the fact that there was no abuse of discretion in issuing this temporary injunction.
Well, Your Honor, I think we have a sufficient order from the court explaining the reasons and actually an analysis of the Dahlberg factors, which is what's required for courts to consider before issuing a temporary injunction. And here we have five different factors under the Dahlberg case. Again, that's Dahlberg Dahlberg Brothers Incorporated v. Ford Motor Company. And the factors are the likelihood that the party will succeed on the merits, relationship of the parties before the dispute arose, the harm plaintiff may suffer if the injunction is denied, public policy considerations, and the administrative burden on the district court. And here we have findings in the district court's order on each one of these factors. And we also have, as Judge Connolly noted, a record that's fairly complete that supports the district court's order, showing that this was not an abuse of discretion. We have pictures of David Ehrlich at a national trade show holding up the very product that he agreed not once, but twice, not to sell for a period of a year after his after his employment ended. So just to be clear, there was a non-compete agreement entered into with David Ehrlich and Web Business Promotions as a condition of employment. And then after 2 years, there was a severance agreement that David Ehrlich ended up executing, where he reaffirmed his commitment to the non-compete agreement. And he says, look, I'm not going to sell a competing product. I'm not even going to work for a competitor for a period of a year. And here we are. We have demonstrable evidence of David Ehrlich just a mere months after the termination of his employment. His employment terminated in January 2018. And we have on May 21st, 2018, pictures of David Ehrlich at a trade show in New York City promoting the very product that he agreed twice not to sell. And we also have Facebook and social media correspondence with certain Web Business Promotions customers, one of which that we mentioned in our brief is Scott, and I can't recall his last name. I think it's Pilkerson. Reaching out, telling Scott on social media, look, I got a great product for you. We're selling milk straws now. Let's talk after the trade show. You know, further, we have David Ehrlich, the former employee of Web Business Promotions, again at another trade show in early July, promoting milk straw products, holding up milk straw products. We have pictures of business cards of his next to pricing sheets, milk straw pricing sheets at a table that he was working at a trade show. You know, the last thing we wanted to do was to bring an injunction. We tried working this matter out beforehand, but needless to say, we felt that we needed to protect, and with limited time, quite frankly, left under the non-compete non-solicitation agreement, we moved for a preliminary injunction. So we believe the court, look, we believe that there's demonstrable evidence that supports the court's decision. Certainly not an abuse of discretion, given that these facts and the underlying record support what the court ended up finding. And again, the court, the district court, breaks down the different factors in Dahlberg, or the different factors as required by the Dahlberg brothers case. And we have a...
Go ahead.
I mean, we have a clear, and if we tease out those factors a little bit more, we have a clear breach of contract here under the non-compete agreement and the severance agreement. And the district court said yes. Look, he was not even supposed to be competing.
So what is your client's irreparable harm that couldn't be satisfied through a damages award in the underlying cause of action?
Well, we were concerned about harm in a couple ways. First off, David Ehrlich was the face of our milk straw business for over 2 years. And he was in contact with a number of different buyers and Web Business Promotion customers. And I'll tell you, Dave Ehrlich's a great sales person. He really built a relationship with these customers, and we wanted a period of time where we could, once David Ehrlich left, where we could train up and get new boots on the ground and introduce those folks to Web Business Promotions customers and say, here's your new conduit with Web Business Promotions. We didn't want a scenario, which is what in fact happened, where Dave Ehrlich was going to get on the phone just a few months after his employment and start reaching out to Web Business Promotions customers. So, you know, the irreparable harm here is that, look, we have an employee that said, I'm not going to compete, reaching out to our customers and swaying those customers and trying to win that business when he was not supposed to be winning that business until January 25th, 2019. The expiration date of the injunction, or excuse me, of the non-compete agreement. You know, again, teasing out some of these factors, Your Honor, you know, there was the relationship between the parties here also favors injunctive relief. The parties agreed freely and voluntarily, say, we're going to agree, or at least Ehrlich says, I'm going to agree not to compete in exchange for, you know, in, for instance, in the severance agreement, for a payout of $7,500. I'm gonna wait, you know, a year until I compete. We're just, you know, and the district court agreed with us, but our position is we just wanted to maintain that relationship, the relationship that the parties freely and voluntarily agreed. And beyond the merits of the case, I do want to just mention here as well that the injunction issued by the district court was really trying to create a sensible solution to a problem where we were worried about irreparable harm, we were worried about losing future sales, and trying to ensure that Ehrlich was allowed to continue his work at Reach Companies. So the district court said, look, folks, if David Ehrlich was allowed to sell water straws, a non-competing product, would that injure Reach Companies? And Reach Companies, on the record, as we briefed here, stated that if Mr. Ehrlich is allowed to continue to sell water straws, there would be no problem with the functioning of the business or the function of Mr. Ehrlich's livelihood. My point is that this was an injunction that was crafted to try to satisfy both parties. When we brought our injunction, we asked for a complete prohibition against David Ehrlich working at the company. We said, look, it is our position, our interpretation of the non-compete agreement, that he should not be working for a competitor. And there's no question that Reach Companies is a competitor. And we said, you shouldn't be working at Reach Companies. And the district court says, you know what? If he just sold water straws, a non-competing product, you know, what would the party say about that? And, you know, we were very clear that if he just sold water straws, if he didn't sell the competing products, if he didn't reach out to Web Business Promotion customers, that, look, we want to be reasonable. We don't want David Ehrlich to not be able to earn a living, to not sustain a livelihood. And, you know, we admitted on the record that we do not believe that water straws is a competing product that we would object to if he ended up selling.
Before your time expires, Mr. Metcalf, I'd like you to address the bond issue that Mr. Christensen has raised, because, you know, certainly a bond is generally required. The court has discretion not to order it, but as Mr. Christensen points out, there needs to be findings. The court's order is silent on any findings as to why it didn't order a bond here, and it seems to me if we were to agree with that, the remedy is a remand to consider a bond on a non-existent temporary restraining order at the time that the remand would occur. How should we address that issue?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that there are enough facts within the record to support, again, as Your Honor stated during appellant's argument, that, hey, perhaps it's the limited nature of the injunction. It only spans a few 4 or 5 months. Again, we also have in the record Reach Companies admitting at the preliminary injunction hearing that as long as David Ehrlich can sell water straws, there's going to be no harm that befalls us. So based on the underlying record, and we think that the district court did not abuse its discretion. It's abuse of discretion standard here on the bond issue. But even if this court says no, you know, first off, if this court says there isn't a mootness issue, and, you know, some sort of findings are required on the bond issue, we believe, again, Your Honor, as you stated, that a remand would be appropriate, a limited remand just on findings related to the bond. Your Honors, I see that my time is winding down, and I just, you know, for the reasons we discussed, you know, we believe that the issue is moot. Again, we just want to continue with the case. We respectfully ask that this court dismiss the appeal on the mootness grounds. However, if this court determines that the issue is still justiciable, we ask that the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Metcalf. Mr. Christensen, you'll have the last word. So I assume you still think it's moot, right?
No. The court hasn't ruled on their request. If the court does rule on their request, I think it's a much more nuanced issue. The question would be, is our effort to seek redress because of the withdrawing of their motion enough to keep the issue live? I appreciate this court doesn't want us to waste its time and doesn't want to give an advisory opinion.
But wouldn't the withdrawal of the motion, it seems to me that bolsters the argument that it's moot because now your client is not facing any possible contempt punishment for, you know, for any actions he may or may not have taken during the pendency of the injunction.
Yeah, and as I said before, it's a much more nuanced argument now, first of all.
You know, it clearly is because, I mean, I am astonished that the person who wanted the injunction is saying it's moot and the person who didn't is saying it isn't. I guess I'm just not getting it. So explain to me why your client, particularly now that the contempt motion hearing is on, still wants us to rule on the validity of the injunction.
Trying not to be flippant here, Your Honor. The first answer
please is be flippant. I mean, at this point, I'm as dense as a post. Well, so clearly, I'm missing the whole case.
Look, Your Honor, the real reason you're asking that question is because it begs the question, would I want to go through, would my client want to go forward with a, potentially still go forward with this evidentiary hearing for a contempt motion just to preserve its right for appeal? Absolutely not. My client's not going to cut off his nose to save its face. That's stupid. But the point is that, first, the court hasn't ruled, and the court will do something. And at that point, I think this court can order us to advise it if the court does withdraw the motions immediately. And I'll do that anyway. I'll let you know what the court says.
The motions have been withdrawn. It's if whether the court cancels the evidentiary hearing. Boy, in 19 years on the district court bench, I can't imagine a district court judge is going to say, no way, we're going ahead with this, even though the party claiming they've been hurt no longer thinks that.
Right, I agree with you, Judge, and that's what's going to happen. So that's why I said I don't want to be flippant. The next point is the much more nuanced one, is that if there were an injunction, if there were a bond and they did this, we would be entitled to seek redress from the bond, regardless of whether or not the injunction had already expired. That's what Rule 54 says. There isn't a bond here, and we seek redress. And that's what we said to the court. And I don't know if this court can actually receive submissions, but if it would like, I have printouts of those letters that were submitted yesterday. You can advise me what I should do with those.
You know, or not. I think generally speaking, the rules of appellate procedure govern as to whether there can be, well, you can comply with however you wish to interpret the rules of civil appellate procedure, and we'll certainly act accordingly.
Well, my understanding is that submissions are discouraged, but the record is fully before this court, so that's why I've identified that those documents were filed yesterday.
So is the point that, Mr. Christensen, you'd like the bond out there because that way, you know, there'll be a sum of money that your client may be able to get a hold of for the issuance of this wrongful injunction, And then it's still not moot because even though this contempt thing is off, you're all going to trial at some point in the future, and maybe there might be some permanent injunction prohibiting, well, I don't know. Whatever happens at that trial might happen, and that's the concern that your client has as to why the case shouldn't be moot. Is that kind of it?
No, it's much more simple than that. It's that we, in December, before they brought their hearing, we said, don't do this. We were going before the Court of Appeals. We don't think you have a basis to do this. They went forward. We had over an hour of a contentious hearing saying that they didn't do what they're supposed to do to bring a show cause order to get their hearing. They then got the hearing. This court wrote a letter saying, in response to our request for an expedited process, saying, if you want to brief mootness, please do. Nobody briefed mootness, and the letter arrives yesterday. And that gamesmanship has what's been going on all along with this case, is that Webb has gotten into my client and continues to manipulate the facts of this case to serve his purposes. And that's why I introduced the record of the trademark case. And that's why I introduced the record of what Webb said in the deposition of the other case. These two parties have been in over a half dozen lawsuits. And when we talked to the district court, it said, if you give this injunction, I guarantee we're going to be back. I see my time is up. I would like to make one more comment.
Briefly.
The real issue here is that the court didn't make the requisite factual findings, and I appreciate this court wants to come up with the right solution, but the point is that, as we brief in our case, Rule 52.01 says that it has to do that. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Thank you, Mr. Metcalf. The matter is submitted. You're welcome. Our next case is the State of Minnesota versus Alan Scarcella.